welcome to the Cognitive Rampage Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Lowry. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your Cognitive Rampage. Strap on your thinking caps for this one today and get comfortable because a very beautiful story is about to be told. I am here to learn on this podcast. I am here to open up my mind as I ask you to do the same as we talk to author Edward Price, the author of The Divine Curriculum. And now this is the volume one that's out. It's a divine design. And it's how God's plan is revealed in the world's great religion. All the religions. Sorry, I said that singular. But it's a long volume. I believe he has about 20 volumes of this to come out. The first volume is released now, which you can get on Amazon. Again, The Divine Curriculum, Divine Design, How God's Plan is Revealed in the World's Great Religions by author Edward Price. And what we're going to learn about today is something called the Baha'i Faith. Now, I know little of the Baha'i Faith, only a few questions I've asked to, say, Dr. Bahia Maroon and a few other people and some research I've done, but what I like to do is learn from those that know extremely more than I do about topics. And learning that way can sometimes assimilate it more quickly or sometimes more personally. So for me, that's why Edward Price is on here. He's going to walk down his life probably. It's really an open format, but I am here to be the student today, as I hope you can be with me. Just open your mind for a moment. I know some people that listen to the podcast are heavy Christian or even heavy Muslim, as we have them both and all over the world, or even atheists. Strong atheists listen to the show as well. So I ask every one of you, if for maybe a moment when you listen, just open it up and take a listen and hear it, because you have to know both sides of most stories, I say, otherwise you're naive to the whole thing. So this is Edward Price, author of The Divine Curriculum. Welcome, Edward, to the show. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. Good morning. Thank you for having me here today.
I'm excited to. You and I have been building this up for a while now. We've been back and forth for almost a month or in change. So I'm as excited as you to learn, actually, today.
Well, that's wonderful. We encountered one another on Twitter, actually, and you became one of my Twitter followers. And then we started exchanging direct messages back and forth and trying to figure out a time when we could both sit together and have this conversation. So a couple months ago, I didn't even know you existed, but now I do, and I think we're going to be good friends.
Well, I appreciate that. There's a lot of people that don't know I exist and still don't. And, you know, I wanted to point out your book for everybody that's watching live or those listening. It's over his left shoulder, our right side, if you're viewing there. The Divine Curriculum is the... up above him there. Yeah. And now we've talked a while about it. And was I correct to say that there's 20 volumes on the way out?
No, gosh, no. My wife would divorce me. No, actually, we love each other a lot. That's a joke. But it's only 6 volumes.
Okay, 6 volumes. Oh, well, volumes. See, in my head and perception, I heard 20.
No. It's been an 8-year project we've been doing this. So
8 years you've been writing this, the all volumes.
Right. Actually, volumes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are already written. And volume 6 is halfway finished. And since it's been a little time since I originally wrote volume 1, I'm currently doing a rewrite of it to bring it more up to date. And that volume will be subtitled, Abraham and Moses. But the section that I'm adding to it now is called Before Abraham. That'll be a part of the book. So that's what the volume 2 will be. And volume 3 will be Jesus. 4 will be Muhammad. 5 will be the Bab. And 6 will be Baha'u'llah. These names I'm mentioning are the great religious leaders of the Abrahamic tradition.
If you would, just go ahead and take the floor, really. I'm going to play student here. And if you would, start out maybe by maybe expanding on the idea of the Abraham definition of those religions?
Well, the term is Abrahamic. And
excuse me. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, 4,000 years ago, according to scripture, and let me say that when I mention scripture, I don't mean just the Bible. I mean Old Testament, New Testament, Quran, Baha'i sacred writings, and other scriptures around the world. So when I use that term, if I use it generally, I'm speaking of all of the scriptures of the world. But in this case, the primary source of information is the Old Testament. And about 4,000 years ago, Abraham appeared in the world, roughly 2000 BC. And he wasn't the first person in human history to think that there was just one God, but he is the first person in history to establish it in a living population. And so we refer to Abraham as the founder of monotheism for that reason. So far, so good?
Oh, yeah. I'm with you. I'm with you all.
So Abraham established monotheism, and then approximately 400 years, roughly, round numbers, 400 years later, Moses appeared, and that too is in the Old Testament. It's the famous story of the Exodus and Moses going up against the Pharaoh and going to Mount Sinai and taking the Jews to the foot of the mountain and revealing to them the law of God. So Abraham was the establisher of monotheism. Moses built on the foundation that Abraham provided and taught the law of God. Also important is that God in the Old Testament promises Abraham that his seed, his posterity, his descendants will be have a special blessed place in the plan of God. So Moses was a descendant of Abraham. And now we're going to fast forward several centuries, and roughly 2,000 years ago, Jesus appears. Well, he was a descendant of Abraham as well. But he continues the teachings that Moses and Abraham had revealed, and he emphasizes the love of God, as well as the coming of the kingdom. And divine salvation is very crucial to his message. So Jesus was in the tradition, the lineage, the actual lineage of Abraham and Moses. And so that's part of the Abrahamic tradition. Well, one of the things that we're going to move forward about 600 years, again, this is really fast. And we're going to go forward to Arabia in the 7th century. And many people don't realize, some people realize, that Abraham had multiple children, and his lineage was expressed not just through the lineage that led to the Jewish people and to Jesus, but his descendants also led to the Arabs. The Arabs were lineal descendants from Abraham. And so Muhammad appeared among the Arabs, and he was descended from Abraham through Abraham's wife Hagar and her son Ishmael and their son Ishmael. So Islam, founded by Muhammad, is an Abrahamic religion. Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
There's people right now probably listening, going, yelling right now. And
well, that's what can I do? I
love it. The connection is, I mean, how practical is that? Even if people are atheists and want to listen to something, that's so practical. Or if they're believers and listen, I love that notion.
It's funny. The Jewish people know this and the Muslim people know it, perhaps not as widely known in the Christian community. But I'm not making this up. This is a truly widely established fact.
Yeah, and I love that.
Yeah, and anybody who wishes to do a little bit of homework could find this out all by themselves. They wouldn't need me to tell them that. Anyhow, let me continue the story forward. Okay, so roughly 1260 years after Islam begins, one of Muhammad's descendants was the figure known as the Bab in 19th century Persia. And one of his contemporaries was another figure named Baha'u'llah. Now, their family trees, the Bab's family tree was direct because he was actually called a Sayyid, which is Arabic, which means lineal descendant of Muhammad. So he actually wore a green turban to denote that honored status. And so the Bab was a descendant of Muhammad, who was a descendant of Abraham. So the Bab was in the Abrahamic lineage too. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Baha'u'llah was also a descendant. They had taken notes already. And Baha'u'llah was also a descendant of Abraham, but through Abraham's third wife, Keturah. So these six major historical figures, first of all, Abraham himself, and then Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, the Bab, and Baha'u'llah, are all of the lineage of Muhammad. And now, of course, the Bab and Baha'u'llah, we have an unusual situation where the faith, the Baha'i faith, is actually founded by twin divine messengers. In the past, the messengers have been just one at a time. But for the first time in human history, God provided two divine messengers in the same century. And so the Bab and Baha'u'llah are referred to as the twin founders of the Baha'i faith. So long story short, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Baha'i are all Abrahamic tradition. Period. Got it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So we like to, and so my book series is about the progression of divine revelation all the way through from the beginning of the Abrahamic lineage to the present day. It's a roughly 4,000 year slice of human history, most of recorded history.
Oh my God, I can't wait to read it. I love history, and I'm stuck on this Dan Carlin's hardcore history, you know, and these right now he's doing the King of Kings, and they're actually talking about, you know, the rise and fall of Babylon, Babylonia, Persia, etc. And how so many times they fell back and forth and back and forth to each other. And, you know, one would topple the other for a while, then the other, and then they overcome and rise again. Everyone thinks about Babylon as just falling and being done in the tower and it's over. And it was built and then rebuilt and invaded. And, you know, I'm listening. I happen to be listening to that since you and I talked. And I thought, man, no coincidence that I'm listening to this. You know, King of Kings is the history, what he calls it on Dan Carlin's show, about just how many kings traded seats all back and forth through Persia. And I think we're talking around 1200 BC on up is kind of where you're picking up this story to religiously, right?
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, the story that I'm telling actually begins around 2000 BC.
Okay, so you're further back. It's
a little bit further back. Yeah.
I love the storytelling and the way the story is being told. And I think a lot of people, it just makes so much sense, you know, practical in history anyway, even minor homework. But, you know, they don't preach it. They preach this, ours is better than yours. But what you're saying is really they're all saying ours is the same one.
Well, I haven't said that yet. I will in a minute. But okay. What I have said is that they all have the same lineage. They're all part of the same lineage. Yeah. And it so happens that what Abraham brought was the concept of, scholars refer to it, and I think rightly so, as ethical monotheism. If you think about it for a second, the idea about one God in itself is relatively inert. You know, it's like a mathematical concept. Is the earth round or is it flat? Well, it's round, so that's a fact. So how many gods are there? There's one God. What difference does it make? It's not that big a deal, except for one thing. If this one God that we have happens to be the creator of everything, and if this one God happens to be the source of all that we know about goodness and righteousness and justice, then this one God is the source of our very definition of what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a good person. So we call it ethical monotheism because all of our notions of morality and what it means to be more than an animal, really, what it means to be a human being originates from revelation from this one God. That's called ethical monotheism.
Yeah, you have me, man. Don't stop now. Don't stop now.
Well, I didn't prepare a speech, so you're going to ask me questions too.
Well, I mean, there's a million running through my mind, really. But honestly, it's so spread out to where people do force this division, you know, even about lineage and history. You know, they split that up. And a lot of people really don't even know the backstory to most of it, right? They know the little qualms or the little stories that come from them on Sunday schools or on Fridays and Saturdays or during the week, right? When people are worshiping in all, you know, faiths. But to really, that's why I like the Carlin part. And then this book is getting into the real history of it. And what we know about it, right? And what we can trace is the lineage. That's what's traceable, right? Or right. No?
The lineage is traceable. But in addition, the fact that there is one God, and if these figures in history that we've been talking about, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, the Bab, and Baha'u'llah, and oh, by the way, outside of the Abrahamic lineage, we mustn't forget there's Buddha, there's Krishna, there's Zoroaster, and in fact, there's many whose names are lost to history, that the number of the messengers of God that have been sent to humanity is unnumbered, going back from who knows how far back. So we only know a number of the ones who have appeared in history, because that's what our historical records have left to us as posterity. But the thing is that if these divine educators, that's how I refer to them in my book, and or divine messengers or prophets or incarnations, or the Hindus like the word avatar, whatever the term is that we use to refer to this exceptional historic figure who is the founder of religions and the founder of civilizations, if there's but one God and they're not all phonies, if they're true figures throughout history, then that means that they're all coming from the same God. And that means inherently there ought to be a unity of logic rather than a division. It's essentially, and this is what Baha'u'llah and the Bab have brought to light, the fact that really what humankind has is not multiple religions. Here's a test question. How many religions are there in the world? Adam, try that out. How many?
3,000.
No.
13.
No. It's one.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because there's one God.
Right. All right. I see what you did there. You pulled a mental health counselor psychology move there, man. That was good. You got me.
Okay. Well, there would logically, if there's but one God, there would be but one religion. Wow. Otherwise, we would attribute to this God something on the order of schizophrenia, right? Okay, that wouldn't be good. Well, no.
Couldn't you just classify it like the other, that let's say singular religions, they just classify the other people as wrong and liars or manipulators of history?
Well, but that's not what the Baha'i message is saying. The Baha'i message is saying that each of these religions were messages or revelations from one God appearing in the timeline of history at different stages in the development of humankind. So it's not my choice or your choice that Abraham was 2,000 years ago. It was God's choice to send Abraham into the world at that time. And it was God's choice to send Moses in the time that Moses was sent into the world. And it was God's choice to send Jesus into the world at the time he chose to send him. And then Muhammad, and then Baha'u'llah, and the Bab. So they each appeared on the timeline of history according to the wisdom and judgment of when God saw fit to send in those revelations to our world. So it's all essentially one revelation. Now, don't misunderstand me. There are humongous differences between the religions. There's unity and there's distinction. Okay, what I would like people to appreciate from my book, and really Baha'u'llah is in the Bab, the brains behind this operation. I get my ideas from them. There is basically one religion given to humanity from ancient times to the distant reaches of the future. just one religion, which we know them as separate religions because we've engaged in division and strife amongst the messengers. And so those who accepted, say, Jesus, became known as Christians, and those who rejected stayed as they were, and they remained Jews. And the Muslims, you know, and so on throughout history.
Well, so what would you say that what corrupted it? I don't even say corrupted it, but what murkied the waters, if you will, from each of the messengers? I like the divine educator definition, that each divine educator really man took a hold of and then murkied the water on purpose for some sort of division, as you said. I mean, I'm being very general. I know you can't speak to every single religion that way, but I'm kind of generalizing the idea.
There is a universal pattern to history. There is a pattern to this that repeats from age to age. It's more or less the story of mankind's interaction with divine revelation is more or less the same story over and over again. The messenger appears, some people accept, some people reject. Time passes, they fight with one another, then another messenger appears, some accept, some reject, time passes, persecutions ensue. You know, it's pretty much the same story over and over again. And so, but I'm very reluctant to blame anyone over this. Basically, what the Baha'i Faith describes is a process of human development. Now, we don't criticize a two-year-old when the two-year-old throws a temper tantrum, or the high school adolescent who gets a little uppity with him or his or her parents. Okay, these are just stages of development. They're not to be. I mean, of course, you don't let the temper tantrum, the two-year-old get away with a temper tantrum. Okay, you don't indulge the temper tantrum. You teach the child, and when your teenage son or daughter seems to be acting out in a way that's, you know, moody or rebellious or whatever it may be, you call them on it. You don't allow it to go on.
Yeah, and you don't hurt them. You don't hit them.
No, I hope not.
I just have to say that I can hear some people in their mind going, that's right, you set them straight. And so yeah. I can see them connected on a religious basis going, that's right. So when that other religion gets out of line, and I'm like, but see, remember, raising children properly is teaching, not violence or fear.
That's right, teaching. As a matter of fact, I'm going to quickly refer to something in my book where the Bab made this wonderful quote. He said, it'll take me too long to find it, but...
No, you know, take me back there, actually, while you're there, is, you know, you were talking about the lineage as it went down, and we had got to the twin founders, if you will.
Okay.
So take me that lineage there in history and what how it begins to develop from there.
I will do that, but let me just quickly paraphrase the quote, which is the path to guidance is one of love and compassion, not force and coercion. I'm saying that to reinforce your point that you just made. This is one of the Bab's central teachings, that we propagate the faith, that now it's the law of God. We do not propagate the faith of God through violence or abuse or any form of coercion. It's a reaffirmation of the fact that we are all granted free will. I wanted to get that quote in. Now tell me your question again.
Yeah, I want to, for the listeners and myself too, I'm going to settle back in and zap back to the story that you were saying about the lineage of history, and you had got down to the twin founders, and take me back to that year, what's happening now, these brothers then, you know, what how's this begin to spread? And
are you talking about the Baha'i Faith now in the 19th century?
Yeah, so yeah, there we go. Thank you. So we're in the 19th century is where we're heading into, just coming out of 2000. And you explain everyone being a lineage from Abraham on down from Moses to Jesus, Muhammad, down to the twin founders of the Baha'i Faith.
Okay, I'd be happy to do that, but it's an absolutely fascinating story. But it will take me a couple minutes to set it up for you. Is that all right?
That's the beautiful part, man. I'm Native American partly and Irish the other half. So we either sit around and tell stories drunk or around the campfire. You know what I mean? So okay. Storytelling is what I love and do. So please, by all means.
Well, the middle of the 19th century was a really amazing time in history. And the place to begin the story is to... For people who are students of the history... You're still there? Okay. Who are students of the history of the 19th century. There was, at that time, going on what can only be referred to as a great millennial expectation. In the West, people had read the books of Scripture, particularly the book of Daniel, and they calculated, according to the prophecies of the book of Daniel, in the middle of the 19th century, that Christ was about to return. Simultaneously, in the Middle East, there was, in Persia, a really exciting movement going on called the Sheikhs, and they were anticipating the promised one of Islam. So going on all over the world, in many parts of the world, there is this resurgence of expectation that the promised one is about to appear. There was also at that time tremendous decadence in Persia and corruption. And so it was a turbulent time as well. So in the city of Shiraz, that's much better. It's much better to see you on the screen again.
Yeah,
thank you.
I'm definitely with you. You're setting that up too, because for me, I'm back in that time to where different, cultures are taking over cultures. There's all types of intertribal warfare and big cities toppling, you know, other big tribes and clans. Yeah, I'm with you.
Well, in the West, this movement was called the Millerites, and they had. They were the actual progenitors of what's now known as Seventh-day Adventism. And so that's where the Adventists come from. And in the East, in Persia, the Sheikhs were expecting their promise. The word they had for that was Qa'im, the promised Qa'im. That's Arabic. Anyway, in the year 1844... there was a young man who was a merchant who received divine revelation. And the revelation said, you are the one, you are the Qa'im. And so...
How did this revelation happen? Is that something you want to leave in the book?
No, it's not mentioned in my book, but it's in volume 5, which the world hasn't seen yet. But... basically, he had a vision of the Imam Hussein, which is one of the sacred figures within the Islamic religion. And this vision basically told to him that he was the promised one for that age, like Moses saw the burning bush, or Jesus, the dove descended on him at the River Jordan, or Muhammad saw the angel Gabriel on the horizon. These are all powerful historic moments, really turning points in human history. Anyway, the Bab had this vision. As far as I understand it, the vision occurred while he was in his home one night. And anyhow, in 1844, he declared to a young student who had been looking for the promised one. They met up, they found each other in the city of Shiraz, and the Bab, we now know him as, declared his mission to this young student whose name was Mullah Hussein. Anyway, Mullah Hussein was followed by 17 other disciples who independently sought him out and found him without assistance, and that they became known as the Letters of the Living, that initial group of disciples. And because there was such a millennial expectation going on in Persia at the same time as this, it's if going back and reading the history of that period, what actually happened is it turned the country was electrified. I'm talking about Persia, which is Iran today. That country was electrified. People converted to, when they heard about it, they converted to the cause by the thousands. It seemed for a few short years, it seemed like the whole nation was going to convert to the new Babi movement, as it was called. But the religious authorities of the time and the monarchy of the time, they arose to persecute and suppress it and kill it. And tens of thousands of Babis were slaughtered in that period of history. The Bab The Bab himself was also martyred in the year 1850. Now, I'm going to shift over to Baha'u'llah. And Baha'u'llah was not among those letters of the living that I mentioned, that first group of disciples of the Bab. But he was one of the earliest followers of the Bab. When news came to him, he was living in Tehran. He had such insight that he received from a messenger one sheet of paper that had the writings of the Bab on it. And he read like a paragraph. And he declared to his brother who was standing nearby, imagine the two of them on the front, you know, on the front stoop of their house in Tehran. And this messenger comes up, hands Baha'u'llah a piece of paper. Baha'u'llah reads it. And then he turns to his brother and he says, this is the word of God. It's a dramatic, very dramatic scene. Anyway, so Baha'u'llah becomes a champion of the cause of the Bab. And he becomes one of the leading figures in the Babi movement. Now, what's so interesting about Baha'u'llah is that he was born into one of the wealthiest families of Persia. He was considered a nobleman.
If I'm proper, at the time, you know, Persia was also seen as a place to, you could keep your own religion. They were mass conquerors. They were conquering all types of lands back and forth, or they're about to. And they were
not also, not in this period, no.
Right.
No. It was an Islamic nation. They followed the Shiite religion, mm-hmm. much as they do today. But there was a period in Persia's history, about 2500 BC, which is a really famous period, when...
Yeah, who was the king?
Cyrus. I'm not really an expert on it. I think it was Cyrus.
Cyrus the Great.
That's right. And
the era I'm speaking of then. Okay, so yeah, this is...
Almost 2.5 millennia here.
Yeah, see, I told you, I'm the dummy here. I'm learning, but for me, I'm trying to set the stage for those, you know, listening in my own mind of what the community is like, you know, what the world is like at the time and what had been happening. So this had already happened. And so Cyrus the Great had risen and fallen.
And other things had happened, rising and falling in the interim almost two and a half millennia. But you're correct to point out that Persia does have a very praiseworthy historical tradition of religious tolerance and understanding, unlike what we see today. But it has a glorious past. Anyway,
yeah, I try to shape that because most people's knowledge of Persia right now is coming from the movie 300, okay?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to really set that precedent of this non-scary, you know, it's not this evil empire that they've been portrayed as in Hollywood movies, that actually Persia at times was a very open place. It was a kind place to be. They were the first to stop putting heads on stakes and hanging kings. I mean, Khan did the same thing before him, but they kind of learned from Khan, I think, and learned that, look, you can take cities and keep the smart people, keep the people okay, and make everybody all right. They almost started that in a way.
Well, we're off by quite a few centuries, but it is correct to say that at times in Persia's history, they were models of religious tolerance and interfaith and those sorts of things. Let me come back to the 19th century. Is that all right?
Yeah, excuse me for being the dummy. I'm just I'm trying to help also people that are listening that, you know, have a, because for me, I had a very negative perception of this age of Persia in my mind until I really started researching and learning.
Well, and that's understandably so. I agree with your point. Anyway, in the 19th century, I mentioned that Baha'u'llah was wealthy and he was a nobleman and his father had been in a high-ranking position in the Persian government. And when his father died, as was customary at that time in that part of the world, the son was offered the father's position in the government. But the point is, Baha'u'llah refused the position. He said, no, thank you. If he had done so, you and I wouldn't be speaking his name, but he would have lived a life of comfort and ease. So,
yeah, I can find similarities already in other religions too.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So Baha'u'llah spent his wealth on taking care of the poor. And the people of his region, even before the message of the Bab had come to him, the people of his region referred to him as the father of the poor. And his wife at that time, she was known by the people as the mother of consolation. It was really sweet, actually. Anyhow, this is the man that, on recognizing one piece of paper, understands that the words of the Bab are the revealed words of God, again, once again, in the 19th century. And the Baha'u'llah becomes a champion and a leader in the Babi movement. And yeah,
the one piece of paper doesn't, you know, it's not two stone tablets, but it's still very short. You know what
it's
I mean?
It's short. And he becomes expert teaching the faith, and he brings thousands of people into the Babi movement. Now, what the Bab has been saying,
can you spell that for me? The Babi movement?
Babi, B-A-B-I, Babi.
Thank you.
It's like Christian is from Christ, okay? Or Buddhist is from Buddha. Babi is of the Bab, B-A-B.
Thank you.
Yeah. And by the way, the word the Bab meant gate or door. And I was just about to make this point that the Bab referred to himself as the gate or the door to a figure even greater than himself. Now, the Bab certainly had an insight as to who that other individual was. And the Bab certainly knew that it was one of his contemporaries. But the people in the Babi community, that was not known to them at this time. And Baha'u'llah certainly knew that he was the one that the Bab was talking about. But he didn't make himself known yet. That would come a little bit later. Anyhow, the Bab was saying that he was preparing the way for one greater than himself. This is very similar to the role that John the Baptist played in relationship to Jesus Christ. He was the herald and forerunner. But unlike John the Baptist, the Bab himself was an independent divine educator with his own divine revelation and laws that he revealed. John the Baptist didn't do that part. So there's similar and there's different at the same time. Anyhow, the persecutions continue. Baha'u'llah manages, it's not politically expedient for the government to assassinate him. Like, they killed so many of the Babis because of his nobleman status and the wealth of his family. So instead, what the government does is they throw him into prison, a place known as the Black Pit, one of the most horrible prisons on the planet. And he's in there for 4 months. And it's in that location, for three stories underground, really that in a place that had been used as a cistern for the Shah's palace. It's kind of really an awful description. But in that place, in vermin and icy cold and in the dark, that's where the divine revelation comes to Baha'u'llah. And we're blessed in our generation that we have Baha'u'llah's own writings where he describes in his own words what that moment of revelation is like. And anybody who wishes to investigate the faith should certainly read the passages what Baha'u'llah describes, what it was like. But he says that the maiden of heaven, that's the vision that he was given. The maiden of heaven appeared in front of him and declared to all heaven and earth that this was the promised one, pointing to the forehead of Baha'u'llah. So this is really a cosmic event that took place. And Baha'u'llah, through his vision and subsequently his writings, describes what took place in that dungeon. And this is the year 1852 when this is taking place. So the authorities couldn't kill Baha'u'llah. He didn't die in prison. So the next thing that they did, the Bab has already been executed in 1850. So in 1852...
For everyone tuning in late, BC, he's not talking about 1852 now.
No, I am talking about 1852 in the 19th century.
Oh, no, you did say the 19th. I'm so sorry, man.
I did say the 19th century. Sorry about that.
Man, I'm being the dummy today. What is my problem?
Okay, it's the 19th century. So it's like 170 years ago we're talking about.
Yeah, how about I just shut up?
No, don't do that. But if you make a mistake like that, I'll just speak up and let you know. Anyhow, let's carry on. Okay. So Baha'u'llah gets this revelation while in prison, and the authorities were hoping that he would die in prison, but he survives. And so when he gets out of the prison, finally they have to let him out because it's proven that he's done nothing wrong at all. He's completely innocent of any, even just no, he's done nothing wrong. So they have to let him out.
And they couldn't just kill him? Did he have a following, or he was just too powerful or too political?
It was political because his family was too well known and he was wealthy at that stage. So what they did is they banished him from the country and they stripped him of all his wealth. So this is when Baha'u'llah gets exiled from Tehran to Baghdad, where he spends about 11 years. And then I'll speed up the story a little bit. He gets exiled again to Constantinople and then to Adrianople. And then finally to the Holy Land, the prison city of Acca, which is just north of Haifa in Israel today. Now, back in Baghdad in the year 1863, Baha'u'llah, this is 11 years after the moment of his revelation, Baha'u'llah finally reveals to the world. He's kept it within himself for 11 years. And he finally determines that this is the time to reveal to the world. And so he declares to his followers that he is the one promised by the Bab. Indeed, he's the one promised by all of the religions of the world. All of them have prophecies and teachings pointing towards him. And anybody who wishes to examine the literature on this subject can verify these points for themselves. They don't have to take my word for it. Anyway, this is all thoroughly documented in the Baha'i materials that we have. Anyhow, Baha'u'llah's ministry goes till 1892. Now, there's another thing that's very difficult for people to wrap their minds around. People often ask us Baha'is, say, well, what is your holy book? And I have to reply to them, well, we don't have just one. Baha'u'llah revealed over 100 volumes of sacred scripture. So we don't have a holy book. We have a holy bookshelf, so to speak. Baha'u'llah revealed over 100 volumes.
And what do you think that, I mean, it seems to be that, right? That everyone points out, well, you got a religion, you got to have a book. If you got a book, you got to have a story. Then you got to have, like you said, right? History repeats itself. The religions repeat itself. It's like you got to have the key points to be able to, you know, put it together. And
absolutely.
So none of these volumes are put together. They're just out.
Excuse me?
Are like the 100 volumes, they haven't been put together in one. They're just kind of all independent.
Well, the revelation of Baha'u'llah is so voluminous, and the level of his expression in his languages were Arabic and Persian. The level of expression is unparalleled in its beauty and its eloquence, and it's really some of the finest literature that anyone in the human species has ever produced. It is for those who know the Arabic Quran, it's on par with the eloquence of the Quran. And the beauty...
Do you know something? Can you quote something from?
From what? The Baha'i writings?
Yeah. Something that moves you. I can tell it was moving you as you were talking there.
Oh, absolutely. Let me quickly find something. I'm looking into my book to see if I can find you a quick passage.
Sure.
Oh, actually, this would be wonderful. I forgot that I had quoted in my book on page 63 from the experience. I was just saying about Baha'u'llah's experience in the prison. So let me read to you a passage, and this is only a part of it. It's actually a lengthy passage, but let me read to you what Baha'u'llah says about his experience in the prison when he is receiving revelation for the, you know, he's being summoned to his mission. It's not like he didn't know he was the prophet. He knew, but he was being summoned like Moses at the burning bush. He was being summoned to his mission. Anyway, here's the passage. One night in a dream, these exalted words were heard on every side. Verily, we shall render thee victorious by thyself and by thy pen. Grieve not for that which hath befallen thee, neither be thou afraid, for thou art in safety. Ere long will God raise up the treasures of the earth, men who will aid thee through thyself and through thy name, wherewith God hath revived the hearts of such as have recognized him. During the days I lay in the prison of Tehran, though the galling weight of the chains and the stench-filled air allowed me but little sleep, still in those infrequent moments of slumber, I felt as if something flowed from the crown of my head over my breast, even as a mighty torrent that precipitateth itself upon the earth from the summit of a lofty mountain. Every limb of my body would, as a result, be set afire. At such moments, my tongue recited what no man could bear to hear.
Oh, that is.
Yeah.
That is. I mean, you can set that scene. I have been incarcerated, and not to this extent, but it seems that in these places of pain, throughout many religions, and even in many people's lives and stories, we seem to have these revelations or insights, and you know the way that's written, you know, it's similar, reminded me of kind of like the Daniel in the Lion's Den story.
Absolutely.
You know, those ideas that, you know, those, I don't even call them ideas or feelings, because they can be, you know, I call them spiritual. And for those that, you know, listen, that believe in anything, at least I know you can tap into a moment in your life to where you have been there, either with someone on a deathbed, maybe yourself, or in a close call, and it went through and things worked out. At least go back to that feeling of that dark place that you've been in.
Well, I certainly agree that we individual human beings have moments of insight, inspiration, whether in dreams or whether in moments of consciousness. But let's make no mistake. The level of experience that is granted to the divine educators is something that ordinary humans like you and me will never know. It is there, whether it's Abraham or whether it's Jesus or whether it's Baha'u'llah, the Bab, or Muhammad, whichever one it is, their consciousness operated on a level that was as advanced or superior over you and me as you and I would be over our pet dog or even an ant. These are truly exceptional spiritual beings of a different order of magnitude.
He was trying to make the correlation for those that, you know, don't believe in a higher power. Those don't believe
it. Absolutely.
For me, it's trying to everyone that may listen, you know, to pull them in and try to start somewhere with a perception. And I too would grant you that same agreement and what you're saying. So
yes.
I don't want anyone to mistake that I was trying to correlate
We're good. But it's just we humans are granted a tiny sliver of that light, which we actually, another word for these figures, we call them manifestations of God, because they are perfect exemplars or embodiments of the attributes of God, like perfect mirrors.
Can we say that our closest experience to something like that is experiencing love or sharing love with others?
It could be. I think it's a very individual thing.
Mm.
I think it's kind of hard to generalize. Human sure. beings like you and me, ordinary people like us, are capable of what we would call a peak or a heightened experience. And I am agreeing with what you're saying. Yeah. I'm just making sure that you and the audience will know that the beauty and the majesty and the exaltation of the experience of the manifestations is a whole another thing beyond what you and I can grasp. And
you've made that very clear.
And God bless them for that. They do suffer. Every one of them, they suffer and they go through hardship. And
can we go back?
They don't have to.
Can we go back there? You know, to him and the vision. He has the writing. You know, yeah. You set the scene well there. And so, you know, where does he go from here? What happened?
You want to go back to the prison?
Yeah,
is
man.
That what you're asking me?
Yeah, I'm trying to get to the very creation of you know, the formation of this as it's passed on to what its form is today.
Okay. Well, I've told you about Baha'u'llah's exiles all the way up to the year 1892 when he passes away in the Holy Land. Are you asking me to go back to the prison in 1852?
No. Yeah, we can. He is in Israel.
He's in Israel. Okay. Now, at this point, from roughly 1868, which is when he arrives in Israel. But of course, it wasn't Israel in the 19th century. Everybody knows that. It was Ottoman Palestine at the time. That's what everybody understood it to be.
Yeah, but let's not travel down the Palestine-Israel debacle.
No, that has nothing to do with this, because we were there before there was such a place.
I just want to make sure, because we could do a whole show just there, so we'll stay on track with where we are.
Yeah, okay.
I think I was saying that for me, not you.
Okay, this is Ottoman Palestine in the 19th century. He arrives there in 1868, and in 1868, he's thrown into another prison straight away. He gets off the boat and he's immediately placed in this even harsher prison. It's hard to imagine a more horrible prison, but this one, he says, is the most great prison. The other one was called the Black Pit, but that wasn't the most great prison. As bad as that was, this new prison in 1868 is called the most great prison. And he suffers with his family in that prison, because his family traveled with him for a little bit more than 2 years. And the suffering that they go through in this prison is just unspeakable. And he continues from 1852 all the way through 1868, the whole period of his ministry, he's outpouring the divine verses, what we call the scriptures of the faith, the letters and the writings that together make up the 100 volumes that I referred to. He's a prolific writer or revealer. And by this time, he's already revealed many important works. He's written absolutely magnificent little treatise. It's actually not a treatise. It's kind of more poetic aphorisms about ethical teachings. That was called The Hidden Words. And then he wrote a treatise on mystical teachings called The Seven Valleys. And then he was asked certain theological questions, and he revealed in 2 days and 2 nights this incredible book called The Book of Certitude, which is available in English. These three that I just mentioned are in English. And many more tablets and letters and volumes that he revealed. And while he's in, and then he's in the prison, and he continues to reveal the sacred writings, and they suffer terribly in the prison. Eventually, after 2 years, the Ottoman authorities relax the restrictions to a small degree, and Baha'u'llah is allowed to move out of the prison and into a house in the city confines, within the city walls, and but it's house arrest. He's not allowed to go anywhere. And he's under those conditions for a number of years. The authorities move him from one place to another for a couple of times. And then finally, I forget the exact year, he's allowed to take up residence in a house in the countryside. And this is as close as he ever gets to really living comfortably again, but not in a fancy way. He lived in very humble conditions, but it was a fairly nice house. But anyway, I won't get stuck on that. And he passes away there in the year 1892, and that's where on those premises is where his remains are laid to rest. And that is a place of pilgrimage, and it's a holy shrine to the Baha'is today. Now, that's outside the city of Akka in the Holy Land. And I was going to move the story forward now after 1892. In 1892, Baha'u'llah has done something absolutely new in religious history. It's like an absolutely an amazing accomplishment, but it's not going to seem like a big deal at first. What he does is he leaves a written will and testament. So he wrote a document with his own pen. He wrote it in his own hand. And he wrote a will and testament in which he appointed his eldest son, Abdul Baha, to be his successor. Now, at first glance, this doesn't seem like such a big deal. So what? He wrote a piece of paper. But it's what that piece of paper accomplishes. Because he has appointed his eldest son in his own handwriting to be his successor, Abdul Baha is his name, which means servant of Baha'u'llah. Because he appoints him in writing as his successor, as the interpreter of his teachings, and as the exemplar of his teachings, this protects the Baha'i faith from division. And that has never been done before. So it has absolutely historic implications, because the most dangerous time for any of the world religions has always been after the passing of the founder. When the time comes for them to go back to heaven, to be with God, whether it's Moses or whether it's Jesus or whether it's Muhammad, the most dangerous time has always been those few months, few years right after the passing of the founder, and the followers are left to themselves. And that's when strife begins. That's when power struggles begin. That's when distortions of the teachings enter into the body of the religion. And Baha'u'llah prevented all of that from happening. He kept the faith unified by this document which appointed his eldest son as the successor. This is not to say that people didn't try to rebel, but Abdul Baha had in his possession what was nothing less than a legal document, even recognized by the Turkish Ottoman authorities, that he was the appointed head of the faith by the founder. And so nothing was able to shatter the unity of the Baha'i faith. So what that set in motion is the fact that the Baha'i faith today is not fractured, unlike all the other religions that have suffered schism and breaking into denominations and all that. The Baha'i faith has escaped all of that.
Well, I think a lot of history, one, speaks to what you say almost exact. From almost any empire being passed down from Alexander the Great's on down, that struggle when there's multiple sons. They've tried to divide up kingdoms. They've done all sorts. And heck, Cain killed Abel. You know, so when you look back at the, that's true that you do speak that. Now, a few kingdoms have tried and tried to be prepared for the pass down, and then murder happens, you know, and a lot of times, and a lot of people would wonder, and I know would question exactly, you know, why are there Presbyterian, you know, all these different versions, if you will, and they begin to spread out like that, almost saying the same thing with a slight twist.
You know, whether you baptize with a dunking or a sprinkling, and, you know, all sorts of disputes have arisen among the...
And the same for the Muslim religion.
Oh, absolutely. Right? The main division between the Sunnis and the Shiites was over the successorship to Muhammad. That was the issue over which they divided.
Right.
And so it is truly of historic and momentous importance Baha'u'llah gave to posterity this document which kept the faith together.
And still today, there's no other small factions or breakouts from the Baha'i faith?
There are people who, there's a couple of small groups that would consider them, you know, claim such a thing. But in fact, what happened is they were cast out by Abdu'l-Bahá when they tried to rebel. And so they have no standing. Okay. The vast body of the Baha'i faith is about 5 million people in the world today. And I hadn't got this far in the story yet. But no, the world...
Tell it how you want, my friend.
But the world governing body of the Baha'i faith is called the Universal House of Justice. It's an elected institution ordained by Baha'u'llah himself in his writings. So we didn't think this up. We're just following his directives. And this institution governs the Baha'i world today. So I stick with my claim that the Baha'i faith is unified worldwide.
Yeah, that's 5 million is strong number for such a short, really global birth, if you will. Where is it based in? Is there like a Vatican, if you will?
Well, recall earlier in story, I told you that Baha'u'llah had been exiled through a series of exiles, and he ended up in the Holy Land. Okay. One of the things that Baha'u'llah instructed his son Abdu'l-Bahá to do was to bring the sacred remains of the Bab, which had been kept hidden for many years, to the Holy Land so that they could be placed in a shrine on the slopes of Mount Carmel, which is the historic mountain of God in the Holy Land. And so during the ministry of Abdu'l-Bahá, I hadn't quite explained that just yet. One of the great achievements of Abdu'l-Bahá is that he successfully built the Shrine of the Bab, and he managed to bring the sacred remains of the Bab himself, his body, which had been riddled with bullets on the occasion of his execution in 1850. 59 years later, he brought the remains of the Bab to the Holy Land and with his own hands placed the remains of the Bab in their eternal resting place. And that is the Shrine of the Bab. The Golden Dome on Mount Carmel is there today. And that's because Baha'u'llah was exiled there, and because the shrine was to be built there, that also became the administrative center of the faith, not just the spiritual center of the faith. So unlike the previous religions, our administrative and spiritual center in the world is in the same location. Okay.
So is all this came, this that letter that you spoke about that he wrote by...
His will and testament.
Right. And this, I'm trying to get the name of whatever the volume or that letter is that he wrote, you know, anointing or appointing his son.
Well, I haven't told you that yet.
Oh, okay.
Well, in Arabic, it's called the Kitabi Ad, but in English, it means the Book of My Covenant. But it's actually only like a 3-4 page document. That particular document is quite short, but it's very beautiful.
Yeah,
it doesn't read like a document. It is a legal document, but it doesn't read like something you would hire an attorney to write for you in America. It doesn't read like legalese. It reads like the word of God. It's just a phenomenon to itself.
Well, in the simplicity, though, is where I know people could see that, is you don't have to dredge through a long, convoluted history, per se, as if here's three paragraphs.
Well, it was like three pages, but it was really short. Now, other works, like I mentioned earlier, the Book of Certitude, that was 200 pages. So different volumes were different things were different lengths. But when I said 100 volumes, I didn't mean 100 specific books. I meant if you put it all on a bookshelf, the letters and the tablets and everything, all of it together would be the equivalent of 100 volumes.
And so has anybody put all that together?
We're working on it. I started to say earlier that the eloquence of the Baha'i writings is such, the language that Baha'u'llah revealed is such, that translating that into the languages of the world is really, it's a multi-generational enterprise.
Doesn't that become the number one issue really with most religions, is that translation through so many centuries?
Well, it does, but we have been gifted in our history with exceptional translators. I haven't got to that part of the story yet, but we have absolutely exceptional scholars in our history, and so we have some of the finest translations in the world. Understand that there's thousands of 2,000 languages in the world, mm-hmm. and so translating it.
Speak to it, because it's that is why it can take so long. That's kind of why I'm pointing that out, is taking the time to do it properly.
Taking the time to do it properly, but at the same time, we already have a lot. If somebody wants to come to the Baha'i bookstore at the Baha'i Temple here in Wilmette, Illinois, there's a whole bookshelf of stuff that they can read in English because it's already been translated. The Baha'i community has not been sitting idle for a century and a half doing nothing. I mean, this translation work is ongoing. And
we
speak.
I even fall right into the social construct. I mean, I just did it. If you notice, I fell right into the social construct of religious construct of going, where's your book? I mean, look at, I'm guilty. I just did it. And at least I'm aware enough to know what I just did. So
I think it's cool. It's all right.
It's funny. That's how ingrained it is, in everybody to look at this, go down the checklist of go, all right, so you're working on your book, right? And that's what it came across as sounding like. And that's not at all what I tried to sound like. And then I realized, I'm like, man, I just fell right into that same trap of trying to listen, without the, and well, right into where's your book, man? I didn't mean to do that at all. So let's get back to the story, because again, I start speaking and become the dummy and fast forwarding. So pick up from where you want to, man. I got more paper.
I told you that Abdu'l-Bahá was the successor to Baha'u'llah. His name Abdu'l-Bahá means servant of Baha'u'llah. He actually chose that name for himself, and he had been appointed by Baha'u'llah in his will and testament to be the successor. Now, this phenomenon of the appointment of Abdu'l-Bahá is referred to in the Baha'i faith as the covenant of Baha'u'llah. The word covenant means contract or agreement. And so there's two sides to a contract. And Abdu'l-Bahá was given certain authorities and responsibilities. And the Baha'is were obligated to follow him and to turn to him for guidance. And to, if they were to fall into a disagreement of one sort or another, instead of fighting about it, which, by the way, is forbidden in the Baha'i faith, we don't fight about a religion. That's not allowed anymore. We turn to Abdu'l-Bahá for guidance, and he answers our questions. Anyhow, Abdu'l-Bahá, in addition to building the Shrine of the Bab, which I alluded to a minute ago, which was a historic achievement during his ministry, he was a prisoner of the Ottoman Empire, just like his father had been. He spent many years in prison, and he actually didn't get out of prison until after the Young Turk Revolution, I think it was 1908. And finally was released along with many other political prisoners of the Ottoman Empire. Anyhow, it took him a few years to get organized. And then in 1912, well, actually 1911, he traveled to Europe. And then in 1912, he traveled to the United States. And then in 1913, he traveled back to Europe. So he was gone for roughly altogether about 2 whole years, the middle of 1911 to the middle of 1913. And these are great evangelical journeys, like St. Paul coming to Rome to deliver the message. You know, this is what Abdu'l-Bahá does. He goes to Europe and he goes to the United States. And if I had the means to show you a map, I could show you the map of the cities. He crisscrosses the United States. There is, by this time, a small but rapidly growing American Baha'i community that has welcomed him and has arranged for his trip to come. And he speaks in synagogues, he speaks in churches, he speaks in universities, he speaks in public forums, he speaks at banquets, and he goes everywhere. And he's invited everywhere. The headlines in the New York Times and other famous newspapers. He comes to Wilmette, which is north of Chicago, and he lays the foundation stone for the future Baha'i House of Worship, which now exists. And we go there, and it's this beautiful, tremendous edifice. He alone lays the foundation stone for this magnificent structure that we, the first of the houses of worship for the Baha'i faith in the Western world. He teaches the Western Baha'is, which are, as I said, growing in number. He teaches the Western Baha'is the principles of his father's faith. And we have the transcripts of his presentations. They took notes. They were excellent note takers. And so we have not only the volumes of writing the published works of Baha'u'llah in English, we also have published talks of Abdu'l-Bahá and his own sacred writings, which were voluminous as well. Thousands of letters and correspondence he engaged. He's shedding the light of his guidance, just like Baha'u'llah had done, communicating with the growing Baha'i community worldwide, causing the faith to spread. And even though it's small, it's taking root in locations all over the United States and all over the world. And some of the great missionary endeavors like ancient, you know, Christian times occurred right here in America in the 20th century.
What are some of the principles of the Baha'i faith? What are some of the principles that he was talking about?
Well, Baha'u'llah had articulated many, and Abdu'l-Bahá gave many cogent explanations of these principles. I'll mention a few. First of all, you have to understand that the Baha'i faith is a strictly monotheistic religion. We are in that Abrahamic tradition of ethical monotheism that we talked about at the beginning of our talk. So there's no doubt about that. We are clearly, unambiguously, unapologetically monotheistic, one God. We believe that God, though, is beyond human comprehension, cannot be understood by the human mind. Any effort of the human mind, however noble and enlightened it may be, is still going to be the product of the human mind, no matter what. And so we're like fish in the fish tank. We can swim around and we do wonderful things in our little fish tank of reality that we live in, but it's still a fish tank and you can't get outside the fish tank. And there's a lot more reality outside the fish tank. And yeah. So.
Yeah. My daughter and I were talking about that, that idea of the unimaginable. That
if you absolutely.
Can you imagine the unimaginable? And then at that rate, right, we started trying to discuss that philosophically, what that really means to be able to imagine the unimaginable.
Well, the fundamental implication is that we human beings should approach the subject of deity, the subject of divinity, with the utmost humility and restraint. What we don't know, we should admit rather than speculate. We should pray to God, knowing that he's infinitely beyond his capacity, and not try to, you know, slice and dice the interior workings of the Heavenly Father. Let him be him himself, and we should stay comfortably in our role as humble creatures made by him. And so once you understand the transcendence of God, and you understand, well, what am I? I'm a creature. I'm not. So I will do well by acknowledging my role in history and my role in creation is I'm just a humble creature.
That's your kind way of saying stay in your lane. And there's one thing
that's a good way to put it.
And that's one thing that us humans do not do well is stay in our lane. And our earth and environments around us, our nature, our being destroyed speaks to that. It speaks to how well we do not stay in our lane. And you can even say that any religion that you can think about has been picked off by a bunch of people, sliced and diced and used to personal or self gain on many occasions. And I've always kind of had an issue with somebody that believes they can interpret words, if you will, that come from something that's supposed to be unimaginable. So if words that come from the imaginable are there interpreted by a man or a mind, then for me, I struggle with even identifying with that.
We have a little echo. I'm suddenly
it's all right. It'll catch back up.
Okay. All right. I think it went away.
Yep.
All right. That was a little startling. Okay. I was hearing myself right back at me.
It was letting you know, man.
Yeah. All right. So I'm not here to criticize anybody else's approach to trying to understand the divinity. But the Baha'i teaching is that God is immeasurably beyond human understanding. And we do well as human beings to recognize our place in creation as humble creatures made by God. Whether that came about through evolution or instantaneous creation is not the point I wish to debate at the moment.
Yeah,
but however it happened, whatever it is, our place in the universe is that we are from God, we are his creatures. Period, end of story. So now, we were talking earlier about this one God, and now I've made it a little clearer that we're talking about this infinite one God. Okay, this infinite one God says that we were created in order to know him and to love him. These are the Baha'i teachings now I'm giving you. It says we were created to know him and to love him. In fact, we are told that this is the purpose underlying all of creation. To know him, to love him, to worship him. This is the reason there is a creation, to know him and to love him and to worship him. So, how do you know the unknowable? Well, there's a mechanism that God provided. We cannot know God directly because it would be like the ant trying to understand the human being. But God, out of infinite grace, the supreme example of his grace and his mercy, is that from time to time in human history, he sends to us these divine educators, these manifestations of God, these great prophets and founders. He sends them into the timeline of history, and they show up in history in a certain place in a certain time, and they teach the people that they are among, and they give to mankind the revelation that is necessary for that stage in humanity's development. And so what we're saying is there's one God. There's in the long scheme, big cosmic scheme of things, only one religion, the religion which comes from God. That the different, what we know as religions is actually simply chapters in a book or stages in a curriculum. And yes, there's differences because from age to age, mankind has needed different teachings according to its stage of development. So what you give to humanity 2,000 years ago is not the same as what you give to humanity today. What you give to humanity 4,000 years ago is not the same as what you give to humanity today. So the social teachings, which are not universal, they pertain to matters about society and morality and culture and worship and practice. These things change from one era to the next. So there are obvious distinctions between one, what we call religion, and another. But universal religion, there's a universal message that is common from age to age. It is universal from age to age. And that is reiterated, re-enunciated, reaffirmed, and renewed one age to the next. But it is also amplified. The message that was given to Abraham is a less complex message than what Moses ultimately revealed and what Jesus ultimately revealed, because these revelations themselves are causing humanity to advance. So why teach the same old lesson over again? It'd be like repeating first grade again and again and again. Why would God make us do that? We don't make our own kids do that. So God advances the message at the same time as he's reaffirming these cosmic and universal themes. So every religion in the Abrahamic tradition has talked about the oneness of God. But our understanding of what that is has developed through these stages. And every religion has talked about prayer. But prayer has gone through forms and development and appropriate to the needs according to the time and the places in history. And every religion has had some idea of what the afterlife would be. But our understanding of what that afterlife is has been given to us gradually and unfolded over time. So we have, going back to Abraham and Moses, a very simple, almost non-existent concept of the afterlife. But through Jesus and Muhammad, the Bab and Baha'u'llah, we now have a very beautifully elaborated image of what the afterlife is all about and what that world is that we're destined to go into. And so every religion has a concept of justice and fairness and morality. But how that morality has worked out in one age to another from another has been different because humanity has been at different stages in its development. So at one time, Moses, for example, taught an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Well, what people have forgotten is that seems so harsh today. You know, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But when Moses revealed that was a progressive model of justice, because in those days, there was no such thing as proportional justice. If you took out my eye, I would cut off your head. So it was unproportional. I would kill your whole family if you did harm to me. So it was disproportionate. So what Moses introduced was proportional justice. Well, then Jesus comes along and he says, you don't have to punish everybody all the time. You can forgive. And things can be made better through forgiveness and mercy. And it's really, really important to love one another. But oh, by the way, loving one another was a quote from the book of Deuteronomy in the Old Testament. So the continuity is there. It's like a beautifully woven fabric. Does that make sense? Okay, so you're just nodding your head, saying nothing. But so this concept of religion, this universal religion, there's been this common thread through all the religions of the world. The prophets and the messengers of God, the divine educators, they all came from the same one God.
Who are these divine educators?
Excuse me?
Who are the divine educators?
Well, we've said it again and again, but we'll say it now. Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, the Bab, and Baha'u'llah are the ones in the Abrahamic lineage. But others that are not in that lineage, but still authentic from God, are Buddha, Krishna, excuse me, and Zoroaster. And we could probably include Adam and Noah, which are also mentioned in scriptures. And the Quran even mentions some other names that are unfamiliar in the West. It mentions two figures known as Hud and Salih. And it's probable, nobody knows for sure, maybe the American Indians had a divine messenger. My personal favorite is Daganoweda, you know, of the Iroquois nation. But I don't know that. That's just a guess. Don't that's not Baha'i. That's just a personal opinion. But the Baha'i writings are saying that the messengers have been coming from age to age, from time immemorial, and will continue to do so. So Baha'u'llah is not the last one either.
I can see. I mean, when you're talking, because you're talking to a guy that has moved from believer, raised Christian, moved atheist, non-believer to this sect place to where, you know, something greater exists, right? The non being able to define it, whatever. And from that practical standpoint is what I'm talking about. It makes so much sense because I know the Bible and the Old Testament. It seems like God is schizophrenic, but what it seems like is, I mean, you lay it out perfect as the change. We need a different rule for a different time, which is why you see application of the Old Testament in today's society difficult. Even application of the New Testament in certain places. Now, metaphorically, Absolutely. Metaphorically, you can pull all kinds of lessons out that apply today. I don't want to doubt that. But you're talking about in the time for its creation and for its words, and that's more scientific to me. And then but it's like scientific and spiritual, right? It's like it was purposefully, as we evolved, what I started pulling from you as you were talking is the concept that really kind of blew my mind for a moment was that if we are evolving and we all understand that we're an evolving species and an evolving time and time is evolving, then if something could be unimaginable, imagine a forever evolving God, one that's always, I mean, beyond an evolving imagination that we can ever imagine, right? That is, and so wouldn't it be the same that as we evolve, as his creations evolve, as our time evolves, that this, look, the religion itself evolves is what I'm looking at, right? And so
do you see my head shaking?
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to reel you in. But
I'm saying no.
I know you are. But just for a moment, what blew my mind was a thought concept that I had really ever crossed it. Is this, if we can imagine an unimaginable God, if you will, that we can't even imagine, then try to imagine even beyond that, almost like a multiverse within inside a multiverse. If we can imagine a forever evolving God on an unimaginable level, you know what I mean? This makes it almost like a double infinity, if you will.
Well, in double infinity is still infinity, so that didn't work. No, but
you know what I mean, and you know what I'm trying to get to.
Well, what you're actually doing now, people in your audience will find this a little technical for a second. What you're actually doing is called anthropomorphism. You're projecting human characteristics onto God.
Okay.
So I would not accept the concept as a strict monotheistic. Monotheistic individual. I would not accept the concept that God is evolving. However, what I would accept is that the human understanding of what God is evolving.
There you go. Okay. You can say it better than me, right? But for me,
it's an important distinction. We're talking about the ultimate infinite cosmic reality, not subject to any human conditions of time and space and learning, changing. God is eternal and unknowable and transcendent. I'm not going to say that God is evolving like there's some Darwinian process going on in heaven.
No.
You understand what I'm saying?
It's
a fine distinction, but I think an important one.
You have proven your point. My point was, I questioned it as a philosophical pondering moment for me. When you mentioned
it, man.
Exploded my mind to think about something you can't imagine also being further beyond that. That's kind of where it draw my thought to. Not to a belief or state of what could be. It's just, wow, whoa. You know, it went farther. So I definitely...
But realize this, that the whoa that you just experienced, and I'm very happy for you. It was a wonderful moment. The whoa that you experienced, understand, occurred within your own mind.
Right.
All that, if you'll allow me to be silly for a second, all that whoa-ing that you just did was in your own mind. It was between your two earphones.
Right.
Okay? So it's still at the human level of reality.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, I'm with you.
Got it? Okay. Anyway, so we've got this universal religion that's unfolding through human history.
Yeah.
If God is one, if the ultimate reality of religion is one, then it follows that humanity is one human race. Now, before I dwell on that, I want to say one thing to the Christian members of your audience before we go into the oneness of humanity. I can imagine, because I've had this conversation thousands of times with beautiful Christian souls who were raised in the churches and who have listened to the teachings of their clergymen and so on. Every one of them out there, particularly of the evangelical groups that, you know, they have been taught this exclusivity claim of Jesus. You know, the only way, true, and no one comes unto the Father but by me. We've all heard these quotes many times before. What I want to say to all those people out there, those sincere believers in Christ and who have been taught to believe in Christ in a certain way, I'd say for the most part, we agree. I, as a Baha'i, for the most part, would agree with them. Because when Jesus was in the world, physically present, speaking those words to the disciples, he was, in fact, the manifestation of God for the age in which he was revealing it. And when Moses, in centuries earlier, made his exclusivity claims, which became the Torah and the law of God and the covenant of God, but using different wording, but making the same exclusivity claim, he was the manifestation of God or the divine educator in the world at that time. Now, here's the thing to keep in mind. All of these exclusivity claims are not actually contradictory. They are actually the same voice of God speaking through different human messengers over and over again.
Why did the light just shine on you like that? Green. That's weird, man. You see that?
Do you understand?
Yeah.
So it's the same voice coming through. Now, I don't want to make this sound, anybody to think this is a trivial analogy. It's like the voice coming through the radio. You know, when Bob announces, "Good morning, everybody. This is Bob, you know, giving you today's weather report." Nobody thinks that the voice that's in is the radio itself. Everybody knows this is a guy like you in a studio talking to a microphone, broadcasting a message. Okay. So I apologize if anybody in the audience doesn't like that analogy, but I'm trying to say that there's a voice behind these divine messengers that is coming through these human representatives of God, these human divine educators that have been sent into the world. And it is the same voice of God, age to age, giving the same exclusivity claim from one age to the next. So as a Baha'i, my devotion to Abraham, to Moses, to Jesus, to Buddha, to Muhammad is the same devotion as I have for Baha'u'llah, because I recognize it as one source. Got it?
Yeah, and for those of you listening to the podcast that aren't watching live, I need you to go back and find this part in the video. Right about the time, you can look through the whole video too and watch his face the whole time. This light never happens. And about the time that you started to say that it's all this coming from the same voice, this bright, like the sun was rising, took over your entire left side of your face.
The left side? What happened to my right?
Well, it's the shadow, but and it went away. And now here we are now, and no light still has come through. Now, watch. When you go back and watch this video, podcast, you're going to see why I sat here quiet when he got done talking. I was like, okay, all right. Look, it's a unity. You know, I'm seeing like this, that unity of all religions is that undertaking through love and the appreciation and tolerance of everybody. And, I mean, united under this one belief of a monotheistic God.
One God. Now, I do want to tell your audience, to the left of me is my window to the outside. So the sun probably came out at the moment that you referred to whatever that light was. I wasn't aware of it because I was talking. But that's probably what happened. You know,
I'm just saying. Watch. You think I'm playing. Watch.
We're having fun, I hope.
No, you watch. You think I'm playing. You go back and watch the video, man.
That'd be great. That'd be great. So I'm sorry. What, I was distracted for a second. What was the question?
I don't think there was one. You were moving to the principle of...
Oh, the oneness of humanity.
Right, the oneness of humanity, okay. Talking about Jesus being the Son of God, the only way through, and the exclusivity, if you will.
Well, I was saying that each of the religions make exclusivity claims.
Right.
But they're valid. In my opinion, as a Baha'i, my understanding of the Baha'i teachings is that we don't get to pick and choose which verses of scripture we like or don't like. So that's not, I don't have authority to do that. And I can tell myself I can do that, but I just fool myself. So we don't, as Baha'is, we don't pick and choose. We're not selective that way. Okay. If it's the word of God, if it's the Old Testament, it's the word of God. There's a way that it makes sense, and it's our task to make it, to understand, okay, to try to grasp the mysteries that are enshrined in these sacred writings. And if it's the Quran, I don't get to pick one verse and reject another, because I like one and I don't like the other. So if these, it's undeniable that these exclusivity claims are very explicit in the New Testament, but what your Christian audience may not know is they're in the Quran too, and they're in the Old Testament if they want to go look it up. So, and they're in the Baha'i writings as well. The fact is that when the messenger of God comes into the world, he is the voice of God renewed for that age in history. And when he says, thus so it shall be, when he says, thus saith the Lord, he is speaking with the voice of authority. He has the authority of God behind him. And if he makes an exclusivity claim, it is true. It is not false. And it's not in contradiction to some other religion's exclusivity claim, because that person too, in his time, was the voice of God speaking with authority. So when we put this all on the timeline of history, we understand that God has been speaking to humanity repeatedly, again and again throughout history. Anyway.
Nobody's listening.
Well, like, some of us are.
I'm saying as a whole, man, I'm like, come on, we're still got nuclear weapons. We're still blowing each other up for division and fake borders that aren't even real.
That's right. Yeah. Anyway, so to the oneness of humanity, Baha'u'llah says that the mission that God has given to humanity in this day and age, and therefore the mission of Baha'u'llah to help bring about, is to establish the oneness of humanity. So this is really extraordinary. For the first time in human history, is actually possible, both technically and spiritually, to unite all the peoples on the planet. We have communications, we have transportation, we have trade and commerce, we have science and technology, and we have a divine revelation which teaches us that we're all one human race. One human race. We have different races that are of no consequence whatsoever, whatever our skin color may be, whatever our ethnicity may be, whatever our nationality may be. Baha'u'llah teaches us, and Abdu'l-Bahá after him teaches us, to look upon all this as unity through diversity, not disunity because of diversity. It's unity through diversity. And he says that we are all like flowers in one garden, and that you don't want a boring monocolor garden. You don't want just yellow flowers or just pink flowers or whatever. You want a flower with tremendous diversity and pattern and design, and you want it to be extraordinary with all of its diversity and beauty and design. So this is the image of humanity that Baha'u'llah gives to us. And he says that in roughly this 1,000-year period, from roughly 1852, which is the year Baha'u'llah received his revelation, to 1,000 years or maybe longer, but not less than 1,000 years, this is the period in history when humanity will, in fact, overcome its adolescent difficulties, depart from its childhood and the brutality of its childhood, and establish on earth God's kingdom, which is nothing less, he says, than the most great peace. So this is the mission of our time. This is the the mandate from God. And what we will discover is that this is a divine civilization. We have a beautiful, tremendous material civilization where we do wondrous things with technology and science and buildings and architecture, and we can feed the planet. We know how to do all these things. We can take care of the planet if we choose to. We have a wonderful material civilization. Even the conversation you and I are having today, think of all the technological pieces that have to come together to just make this program today come together. We have all these things. We can talk. This word message can go out all over the world. We have the technical means to establish unity. What we need is the spiritual change so that we can unite as a human race, morally and spiritually, ethically and socially. All the nations, not just I love my brother, my human being as individuals. That's very, very important, the individual level, but it's collective as well. It's the peace among the nations that is just as important. And Baha'u'llah has given us teachings. He's told us that religion and science are in harmony, that the economic problems are fundamentally spiritually caused. That's my phone ringing. I'm going to hang it up. I'm going to quickly hang that up.
Are there any gender separation differences taught by Baha'i?
On the contrary, the Baha'i faith is the first religion to make it a matter of its religious law that establishes the equality of men and women. This is the first time in human history. And one of the famous Babi martyrs, her name is Tahereh, when she was moments away from being martyred, the last words that she spoke was, "You can kill me as soon as you like, but you cannot stop the emancipation of women." And our writings say, in more recent times, that achieving the equality of men and women is one of the prerequisites for world peace. There will be no world peace when 50% of the population is dominating 50% of the population. It's just not going to happen. That's one of the prerequisites. Baha'u'llah said that the nations of the world should come together and establish the means for governing the world in peace. That ultimately the nations will agree with one another. Not the Baha'is enforcing this, but the peoples of the world and the nations will agree to demilitarize the planet. We won't need so much arms and weapons, like you mentioned earlier. It will literally be the fulfillment of the prophecy of the book of Isaiah when we beat our swords into plowshares, like at the front of the United Nations today. These are just some of the teachings of the faith. He says to investigate truth. Baha'is are told not to inherit their religion from their parents as if it were something genetic. My mom and dad are Buddhists, so I'm a Buddhist. Or my mom and dad are Muslims, so I'm a Muslim. And I just adopt it because that's what I was told. No, 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 no. That's not the way of the future. The way of the future is that we teach our children about the truth of all of the religions that have been given to humanity. And we ask them, we place it as an obligation, that they must investigate truth and they must choose for themselves which religion, if any, they wish to be. And we ask our Baha'i children to do this at around age 15. I have a daughter, but her name is Alyssa. And as we raised her, my wife and I, her name is Ellen. As Ellen and I raised our daughter, we took her to the synagogue and we went to churches and she had opportunities to listen to Buddhists speak. And she's had interactions with Muslims and been to the mosque. And so she's had opportunities. We made sure she had these opportunities. And when she wanted, just in a side note, when she wanted to play with dolls, we gave her an African-American doll so she would know that that was something normal and good. And so back to the religions. So we taught her the religions of the world. And then when she was about 15, she made the decision for herself. Of course, as a dad, I'm very happy that she chose to be a Baha'i. But the Baha'i law is that I have to respect whatever decision she makes.
Wow. That's, man, these are the principles that you were laying down seem so new age, but yet not.
Well, they are the new age, but they're new. They're not new agey in the sense that they're like a fad of the moment or some pie in the sky dream.
Right.
Because unfortunately, the Baha'i Faith's vision of history recognizes that in order for humankind to achieve these goals, there will probably almost certainly be periods of tremendous suffering and hardship. And that's tragic and it's heartbreaking. So the passion that animates a Baha'i in his or her daily life is, what can I do to be of service to mankind to help mitigate these sorrows and to spread these teachings so that the peoples of the world, not by force or coercion, like I quoted to you earlier, but through love and compassion, will open their minds and become more willing to adopt these teachings. Whether they embrace the faith or not, tremendous strides can be made if peoples of the world could learn from the teachings of Baha'u'llah. Many will want to be Baha'i. Many may not choose to do that. We're going to love everybody because humanity is one. But to the extent that these teachings become mainstream, humanity will solve many, many of its difficulties, whether they're economic difficulties or whether they're political difficulties or whether they're social difficulties or whether they're humanitarian concerns, lack of literacy or starvation around the world, whatever it is. The more these principles are applied, the more all of these problems will go away. The oppression of women, that will disappear. The caste system, it will go away because the oneness of humanity won't allow it. And so once these teachings become widespread and mainstream, when they enter the body politic of humanity, society will be transformed from the bottom up, from the inside out. And it will be a beautiful thing to behold. And that's what we Baha'is live for. That's our goal. So there you go.
And that's what I call a spiritual rampage.
I love it.
Yeah. Will you do this again with us?
Are we done? Okay. Well, it's been like 2 hours already.
Yeah. 2.5 almost, man.
I would love to do this.
Let's come back.
A wonderful time.
We're going on tour. Let's come back in 30 days after we get back from tour and let's pick up the story from where we are. I got some serious notes and I'd love to pick up with this because I think that's where we got to end this cast, man. You just laid something down beautiful. And,
there's much more to tell.
And we're going to listen.
I haven't told you yet what the Baha'is are doing in the world today. I haven't got to that part of the story yet because we kind of stopped during Abdu'l-Baha's ministry. There's more of the history to tell. But also, you know, maybe we can pick up some themes with my book. And I'm going to ask you, I'd be happy to send you my book, or if you want to go on Amazon and buy it, either way, in 30 days, could you maybe try to have read the book?
Yeah, I'm going on tour with my book, man. I'll be on tour.
I had a wonderful time today. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
Yes.
Your questions are wonderful. I really enjoyed it a lot.
Well, we're going to pick up. I wrote down on my notes here what the Baha'i is doing today is what we're covering next time. Is there anything else you want me to jot to note here? Oh, yeah, more on your book. I think that's going to develop into your book, I think. All right, and then let's go into the book on the next notes. Oh, man. What a beautiful conversation, man. Thank you, Edward.
Well, I've had a wonderful time, and thank you once again for this amazing opportunity. And I hope that all of the people out there in your audience, if they're listening, if I've said anything that's troubling, you said you were going to send out my contact information after the talk. If any of them in the audience wish to write me, I sent you my email information. So if anybody wants...
Don't put your address out there.
No, it's not my personal address. It's my publisher's address.
Okay.
So it's okay. It's okay. It's just for this purpose. And so I created this email address so that I could talk to the public. Anybody who wants to talk, I'm happy to, you know, anybody who comes in peace, I'm happy to talk to them.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you would, if you have it on hand, tell people where they can find you.
Okay. Oh, very good. So, you and I found each other. Actually, you found me on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So let me give my Twitter handle first. You know, the at symbol. And then it's very, very easy. Edward A. Price. At Edward A. Price. That's my Twitter handle. P-R-I-C. Yeah,
that's the best way to find you. That's where how I found you and contacted you.
Okay. Now, the email that I was just referring to, which I created so that the public could communicate with me if they wish, is eprice, E-P-R-I-C-E, and then the at symbol, and it's calumeteditions.com. I'll spell that. calumeteditions.com. C-A-L-U-M-E-T editions, editions.com. Eprice at calumeteditions.com. And I'd be happy to talk to anyone who wants to write to me.
And they will. And I know you will, too. You'll definitely answer questions, you all. And please, if you email him or call, watch the curse words. I took a challenge to myself that...
You did great. I'm so proud of you.
You like that. So
I'm very proud of you. Good job.
In all his mastery wizardry, called me multiple times and eventually convinced me to challenge myself that as a... mental guru, shouldn't you be able to make a podcast without a curse word? And I said, well done, sir. And I said, I will challenge myself. And I believe I made it the entire podcast without one curse word.
You did an amazing job. I'm very proud of you. I simply said to you that I couldn't do a book about God with curse words. So, and you heard me. I was very grateful for that. You got my point of view. And you decided to stretch your, you know, because I know from your other podcasts, you occasionally use one or two of those.
Occasionally.
So I asked you politely and humbly, and you more than met my expectations. So you did a great job.
Thank you. We're not out of here yet, man. So I don't want to boast about it too much.
No, you're good. You're good. You're good.
So I want to tell people that, to pick up the Divine Curriculum, please, and start now because there's 20 more million of them. Now, there's six of them coming out.
There's six.
Yeah, there's six volumes coming out behind it. But everyone can pick that up on Amazon. It looks like you got some prepared there to tell everybody about where to find your book. But
no, it's just if the best way to find me is if you Google in the search box Divine Curriculum and then Price, my last name, it'll come up as the first book. Or if you go to my Twitter page, there's a link there. It's the first pinned tweet. You can click right to it. And since you're giving me a chance to make a commercial here, there's a Kindle edition for $4.99 and there's a paperback edition for $18.99. And I'm very proud of the fact that I have 13 reviews right now. And all of them are 5 stars, not a single one less. So far, so good.
And the reviews also don't count for how many really read it, because reviews are difficult to get people to go do on Amazon. Oh, yes. So for those of you listening, don't judge the reviews by volume sold at all.
Well, 10 or 8, 10, 13 reviews is really just the minimum. I'm still trying to accumulate reviews.
Yeah, so please, if you've read the book, take the time to go to Amazon, find the Divine Curriculum by Edward Price and leave a review there. Reviews mean a lot. They really help people find the book when they're searching. So reviews can mean a lot. And it takes some time to do so. You took a lot of time out of your life, man, to write that book and put those beautiful things together that I think a review is worth somebody's time for sure.
Well, here's my book. I'm going to put it right up. Ooh, can you see? It looks backwards. Can you see it?
Oh, yeah, we got you, man.
Okay, does it appear correctly? It looks backwards on my screen.
No, brother, you look beautiful, man. Okay. Even so that beautiful face just to the left of it. Look at it.
Okay. There you go. Thank you very much for the shameless plug. I appreciate that.
Anytime, man. Anytime. Those shameless plugs drop out all the time.
And your book just dropped too the other day, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It is now available on Amazon. You can simply search The Cognitive Rampage. It will pop up, but the full title is The Cognitive Rampage, A Dose of Authentic Revelation. It is the Black Edition. It is on the market. It's in bookstores. It's on Amazon and Amazon Europe and everywhere else.
Hey, man, I really look forward to our 30 days or so from now to pick up where we left off on this story.
That'd be awesome. Thank you so much. I've really had an immense time.
Oh, man. Thank you, Edward. And thanks for sharing everything that you believe, man, and sharing from the heart and coming so lovingly and openly with us here, man.
Okay.
All right, man. I'll see you soon. Take care. Love you, man.
Take care. You too.
Bye.